Check. DPS.
Go.
Inco.
Go.
PUS.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Booster.
Go.
Copy that. We have a go from you guys.
This is Talking Sound.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the Talking Sound Podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, coming at you live from Austin, Texas. This is the only podcast where negative 10 is a number to be desired. With me today, I'm going to give you a little sound clip. I'm going to take you on a Wayback Machine trip here, audience, for about 10 seconds. I want you to hear one of the most familiar sounds from my youth. That is the sound of Q-Bert, the original Q-Bert game from Atari, from the Atari 2600. I cannot believe that I have the extreme pleasure today of welcoming Warren B. Davis, one of the creators of Q-Bert, that came out by Gottlieb in 1982. I had the extreme pleasure of working with him at the recent classic game convention here in Austin, Texas. He was a presenter at one of the panels, and I thought his presentation was great, and the fact that I got the chance to meet a legend in game creation was really an incredible opportunity to bring this to the audience and kind of cover what video games were whenever they were first getting their real hold on America and the audiences of America, and what they've come to. And like we were saying off air, how it's a totally different production process than what it used to be and what it's all about. So welcome to the show, Warren. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. I do have to make a little correction. In your intro, you said you played the sound of the original Q-Bert for the Atari 2600. The original Q-Bert was the arcade version.
It was the arcade version. That's true. That what I have was a 2600 arcade game that I plugged in and played and captured the sound of. But that is true. The original Q-Bert was an arcade release. That was one of the things that Atari really did well, was to take games that we loved. They were really one of the first companies to take games from the arcade and bring them into your home. And it was, what was it like for you to be on the cusp of that industry right as things went from mechanical pinball to 8-bit video games, things like that, Warren?
Yeah. I mean, I actually sort of came in on the tail end of that era because, you know, the first video games came out in the early 70s, you know, the very simple ones, Space War and, you know, Pong. And really, it was through the 70s I experienced video games just like everybody else as a player. I didn't really start working at Gottlieb until January of 1982, which, you know, at that point, Pac-Man had already come out. You know, the industry had already evolved beyond little black and white blocks and has gone into sort of cute characters. I missed the very earliest days, but it was kind of the tail end of that golden age, and there was certainly still room, as I found out, to be innovative and to try new things.
Well, and getting into some of the creation of Q-Bert, number one, was that your first attempt at game programming, at game creation? Where did you actually get your foothold in the industry, and was gaming your first go-to as a programmer?
Okay, that's a lot of questions, so I'll try to answer them all cohesively. So my background was in computer and systems engineering. I got a bachelor's degree from RPI, and that's where I started playing video games because they were coming into the student union, and I was fascinated by them. I was amazed by them, and since computers were my chosen career, at the time I was looking at myself as sort of a hardware software guy. I didn't know that I wanted to limit myself to one or the other. But I was just so amazed by video games. I was like, my God, how do you get a job doing this? I was always fascinated by the use of computers as entertainment. even before video games. And, you know, that was just something I felt computers had a huge potential to entertain people. And so when video games came out, I definitely was interested, but it seemed like a far flung dream. I didn't know how to get a job like that. And out of college, I worked for Bell Laboratories in suburban Illinois outside Chicago. And part of the requirement was I get my master's degree. So I actually went to Ohio State for a year, got my master's in electrical engineering. And then I came back and then I had a job. I worked with Bell Labs for a little while on a job that sort of had me traveling a lot. I would travel to a different city for, you know, 5-6 months at a time, then come back to Illinois. And that kind of got tiring for a single guy. I really wanted to, you know, be in one spot. Anyway, so I quit my job. I quit my job with no other job in sight. And I had become enamored of Second City, the Second City improv troupe in Chicago. Okay. So I started going into Chicago a lot to watch them, and I thought, oh, man, I think I could do that. I had no desire to be an actor, but I somehow improvising, that felt like something I might do. So I started studying that. I had no job, and I was basically an unemployed wannabe improviser for a few months.
Oh, wow.
And then after a few months of that, my savings from my engineering job were dwindling. I started looking in the Sunday paper for, you know, at the want ads for engineers, even though I kind of said to myself, I'm not going to go back and take another engineering job. I just didn't feel like I fit in with engineers. But I started looking in the ads because I knew I needed to make some money. And I actually found this ad by Gottlieb looking for video game programmers.
Oh, wow.
And I actually thought twice about it. I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't want to go back and be an engineer again. Now I can't believe I even thought twice about it. But I also said to myself, well, look, if I don't like it, I could quit. So and they may not even want me. So I put together a resume and I sent a letter, cover letter and a resume. And I got an interview and they hired me. And next thing I knew, I had a job making video games.
Oh, wow. And it's interesting that there it was in front of your face. I very much ended up in video in the same way. Mm-hmm. had left teaching, all kinds of stuff, and was looking through the paper one day, had been doing music, had been doing recording, all kinds of things, and had played around with some video stuff and had considered it. And I saw a job posting for somebody looking for an opening position at a video editing suite. And I was like, yeah, I think I'll give it a shot. And just kind of went for it. Not anything that I had an extreme background in. I had an extreme background in using audio equipment and using mixers and things. So it was a natural transition to go from editing tape in one thing to editing tape in another. But for you going from the world of a system programmer to going to the programmer of worlds,
it wasn't quite that dramatic. It was 1982, well, after all.
It was, and it was a 2D game, but you do still have to like program in physics into a game. You have to consider these things whenever you go to create a game. So you are, in a sense, creating a world, and you have to kind of, I would think anyway, consider it that way. That you're creating a space other than what you're in to transport the user to.
Well, I mean, when I started at Gottlieb, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I had to do. I mean, to their credit, the guys who ran the department, Ron Waxman was the VP of engineering and Howie Rubin was the VP of business development. And, you know, they really gave the programmers their carte blanche to do anything, because one of the things they realized is that they didn't know what a good video game was, and they were they kind of believed nobody really knew what a good video game was. So rather than try to impose stuff on a group of programmers, they just let us loose. They gave us a lot of freedom, which I think worked out for them in some cases, but also kind of backfired as the company grew. And they ended up with a lot of programmers, none of whom were actually producing games that they could sell. But that was later. At this time, the department, when I was hired, the department was still pretty small, and they had not even come out with their first in-house video game. It was a fairly new department, and they hired Tim Skelly, who was, to us kind of a guru and a mentor, but they hired him to develop a game for them on their hardware that was developed in-house. And that game became Reactor, and it was released later in 1982. So when I was hired, Reactor wasn't even finished.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was still in process. And but anyway, getting back to your original question, I mean, you know, maker of worlds. I didn't know what I was doing, so I had to teach myself things, like even physics, you know. I did not know how to simulate physics in a video game. So I had to learn that. And that, in fact, was the start of Qbert, because I took it on as a programming exercise to have balls bouncing down this pyramid of cubes. I had to teach myself how to program both randomness and gravity, which I did, you know, with some help from Tim Skelly. Tim, I remember, had a random number generator that he let me. He explained how his random number generator technique worked, and so I borrowed that. And then, you know, the physics, you know, pretty simple. You just have to add a quotes unquotes velocity, which is the number. You add that to your Y position every frame. To get you add an acceleration, I should say, to every frame to get your velocity, and you add your velocity to get your distance. Simple physics, but I'd never done that before, so I taught myself how to do that, and then I had balls bouncing down a pyramid.
Well, and at the time that Qbert came out, how many games out on the market were using? I know that like Donkey Kong was out, things like that, but it didn't necessarily move in the same kind of way. It was still a very static, just left up, you know, very Frogger-esque purposed movement, as opposed to the randomness that Qbert had.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't seem that different to me, honestly. It started with the pyramid. So when another programmer, Kan Yamamoto, had this, his screen was filled with that Escher pattern. It's an MC Escher based illusion that looks like a cube. So he had, and I'm sure it was Jeff Lee that made that Escher pattern for him, but he wasn't doing anything with it. He was literally just using it as like a static backdrop. And he was playing around with switching foreground and background, which was something our hardware allowed you to do. But he really wasn't doing anything with the Escher pattern. So when I looked at it, and it filled the screen to the edges, but for some reason when I looked at it, I imagined it as a pyramid. Because if a ball fell on the top, it would have one of two ways to bounce, down left or down right. And so two things is binary, which, you know, we represent with a bit, and 8 bits makes a byte. And with one random byte, I would have the path of a ball from top to bottom. And that's all I was thinking about. So, you know, I had no context of what this meant in the world of video games. I was just trying to teach myself randomness and gravity, and the fact that it looked cool and three dimensional just was a lucky bonus.
Well, and you know, even speaking of that, going from just it starting out basically as a lesson, an exercise for you as a programmer, how did it evolve from that into a game? How did you really start to see the fact that, hey, wait a minute, this could be turned into something else. This could be very much used as the structure for something else.
Well, it started with reactions from, the other guys in the department. So we all, could see each other's work. We actually, at the time, we were at a plant in Bensonville, which was away from Gottlieb's main plant in Northlake. So the video department was very protected and somewhat insular because we were apart from the rest of the company. But we worked in a big room. Most of us were in this one big room. We had to share systems. We didn't even have enough development systems to go around. And we would always be able to see what each other was working on. So once I had this pyramid with balls bouncing down it, people would come by and they'd be like, wow, that is cool. They didn't know what it could be. I didn't know what it could be, but everybody seemed to think it was a cool thing. So for me, because my job was to make a video game and I had nothing. I mean, this is what I had. I said, all right, well, let me put a player onto this play field. I started to imagine that the pyramid was now my play field. And I said, well, let me have a guy jumping around. Now there's a guy you have to control. That was also the next thing I would have to learn. So I went to Jeff Lee, our artist, and I said, do you have any characters lying around I might be able to use? And he showed me, he had a whole bunch that he had thought of for some game that he was trying to envision or trying to get made. But unfortunately, at the time, Gottlieb's management, the programmers were the designers. And Jeff never really got to be in charge of his own project there. But he had all these characters, and I picked the one I liked, which was the big round orange one with the long nose, because, he looked kind of pathetic. And I thought that was a good quality in a player character. And, then he made different angles and the stuff I need. I told him what I would need and he would supply it. And then I would program this character jumping around the play field. And honestly, every bit of the game just happened sort of, it was an evolutionary process. So none of it was really pre-planned. It's just every time I implemented something, I would say, well, what should I add next? And it just literally kept on going that way. Now, there was a point where I realized, I had the balls. I had a guy, a little character jumping around. I realized he's going to have to avoid the balls. So I programmed collision detection, which was a little tricky as well, since it's a pseudo 3D game, but actually on a 2D screen. Yeah. So I'm doing all this stuff and learning how to do all this stuff. But it's not, there's not a game there. There's no goal. And that happened one night when I was working and just sort of playing around with it and, trying to be inspired and see if something came to me. And our VP of engineering, Ron Waxman, was sitting behind me. I mean, he had this habit of doing things. He would stay late and sit behind people and just watch them work. And he would smoke a cigar. He was a big, round, large man. And he wouldn't move very much, but you could hear him breathing and the cigar smoke. And you kind of just tuned it out. But I'll never forget, I was sitting at the table. It was late at night, and he was there. And I'm jumping around on the pyramid, and he says, well, what if the squares change color when you land on them? And it was like a light bulb going on. I was like, yes, that's a great idea. So that's how you had a goal to complete the play field. And then that's when I started to think, oh, wow, this is actually a game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And from there, we were off and running. Yeah.
And from that point, there are so many different elements. One of the things that sticks with me to this day that my ears cue in on things, the beginning of the Shinobi soundtrack from like the original Sega Master System, there was just this crazy little sound effect that happened and my ears could cue in on it in an arcade. The sound of Qbert's voice for me, the holding screen where Qbert just popped up and was like, with his voice. That was one of those that was, it, it was like the smell of gumbo in my grandmother's house. You know, you could find your way to the kitchen easily if you didn't know where it was. Sure. You could find your way to a Cubert machine amongst everything. It was like hearing the sound of Pac-Man dissolving. You know, it was so vivid in a memory. Where did you come up with the idea for Cubert's voice? How did that come about?
Well, the sounds in the game were all done by Dave Field. And, you know, some of those sounds were suggestions that I made to him, things like that. Like I had an idea for a sound and I would try to sort of mimic it or say it. And then he would try to implement it. But the random gibberish was his idea. And he had so our soundboard had a speech chip on it. It was called a Votrax. And, you know, it created speech by the programmer would string together phonemes that created words. But it sounded terrible. It sounded robotic and sometimes hard to understand. And Dave absolutely hated this chip. But he had the brilliant idea to just send it random phonemes. You know, we had this notion of Cubert, swearing. And again, I'm not exactly sure where that came from. It was sort of a natural outgrowth. Jeff Lee was involved, you know, with the cartoon balloon. And Dave was like, yeah, if I just send random numbers to this Votrax chip, it'll just play random phonemes and it sounds like swearing. So that's where Cubert's voice came from.
And, you know, even the exclamations that Cubert makes, the inside the bubble, that has become so memed in our society and such an ingrained part of comic books now, things like that. Just the idea of letter substitution for something utterly random. Like, I don't recall seeing it as a kid. I see it all over the place now. You know, I see it in people's posts everywhere.
Jeff did not invent it. It did happen. It happened in comics. You would frequently see, and that's where we got it from. I mean, you'd see in comics, people would, you know, get hit on the head. And, you know, sometimes like in cartoons, you'd see little birds and stars fly around them. But, you know, in print, I think you would see something where that or in comic books where when somebody cursed, there was some string of those symbols. And I think that's where Jeff got the idea from. It wasn't like a completely original thing, but yes, it was a great use of it.
Yeah. And, you know, even now with Cubert, I guess, kind of making a comeback in modern things, being in movies like Pixels, stuff like that. There have been numerous iterations of Cubert throughout the years of him existing. Everything from cartoons to even new video games being made and stuff. How much of that have you been a part of?
Oh, zero. Absolutely none.
I think that's an important thing for people to realize, though, because it's something that people really don't understand in the video game world, in the music world, especially like the people who engineer albums have just recently been allowed royalties. You know, like for years, the people who made albums sound the way that they are got paid their wage to go into the studio that day and mic things up and record like an album that sold billions of copies and made somebody a multi-platinum artist. And they're just like the dude that goes into work the next day and rolls up some cables and, you know, not many people realize that, like, the same way that Marvel Comics, the people that created the characters, don't own right to the characters. It has a lot of that changed in the industry now, as far as character creation, things like that.
Well, I couldn't tell you that because I haven't been involved in the industry really for quite some time. But, you know, I really think it's just a matter of what you negotiate. And if you like, certainly some video game creators, once they achieved a certain level of success, could negotiate that they would retain the rights to any characters that they created. That's just up to an individual to negotiate. I don't think there's any rules about it. Qbert was my first game. I was an employee for Gottlieb. And when I was hired, just like everybody else, I had to sign something that said anything I created belongs to the company. So, you know, there was and I was not in a position to negotiate.
No.
Basically a guy off the street. So I've never owned the rights to Qbert. I've never owned the character. I've never made any money off of Qbert other than my salary. And they did give me a very small bonus, which was kind, you know. But they also, I should say, Gottlieb instituted a royalty program after the success of both Qbert and Mach 3. I don't know if you remember, but Mach 3 was a Laserdisc flying game and shooting game. And that was also a big success for Gottlieb. And after that game, they instituted a royalty program that would allow the creators to you know, a pool of money based on our sales. But it was not retroactive.
And it was from that point forward.
They used Qbert as an example. They said, so, you know, if Qbert had been made under the royalty program, well, Warren would have gotten like $110,000.
Yeah.
but he didn't, and it wasn't. So but honestly, I mean, I'm not bitter about that because it what I got was an opportunity to make a video game, which was phenomenal, and I'm ever grateful for that. And the fact that it was successful kind of gave me carte blanche at the company. I mean, I literally could work on anything I wanted to work on. And honestly, after Qbert and after, well, faster, harder, more challenging Qbert, which we can talk about if you like. But after that, I was pretty much done with Qbert. I felt like I had done that. And I really wasn't interested in sequels and keeping the character alive. I had so many. I mean, this was my first game, and I had so many other ideas I wanted to explore. So Neil Bernstein, who was another programmer at the time, came up to me a couple of months after Qbert was sort of over and done with. And he said, you know, I've got an idea for a Qbert game. Do you mind if I do it? And I was like, go ahead, have some fun. And so he made Qbert's Cubes, which, you know, was his thing. I wasn't a big fan.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it was a bad game. I just, you know, I thought it was a little too hard and a little complicated, but, you know, it didn't do well as I recall for Gottlieb, but, it was made and there was a pinball of Qbert's Quest. So they did try in some ways to keep the character alive, but, then, of course, Gottlieb was shut down by their parent company in 1984, I believe, and the rights to Qbert just reverted to Columbia Pictures, and they didn't do anything with it. So here's a little funny story.
Wow,
Columbia 1990s. I'm working for Disney Interactive, making, you know, home games. And I go to the game developers conference up in San Jose, and they have like a little area where different companies are, you know, I guess like a job fair kind of thing where they just have representatives of different companies there to meet people. And sure. I went to the Sony table because Columbia Pictures, that as far as I knew, Columbia Pictures owned the rights to Qbert because they were Gottlieb's parent company. And then Sony bought Columbia. So I went to Sony and I said, you know, I'm just curious, how come you guys don't do anything with Qbert? Now, this was in the 1990s when there was a resurgence of nostalgia. In fact, it was the original nostalgia for old video games happened.
Oh, yeah.
I want to say like in the mid 1990s. And I said, how come you're not doing anything with Qbert? And they're like, Qbert, why would we do that? And I'm like, well, you own the rights to Qbert, I think. They were like, we own the rights to Qbert? I mean, the Sony guys didn't even know that. And then a year later, there was a new home version of Qbert.
That's one way to create your own relevance there.
Well, it was, and I had nothing to do with it. I remember at another show, I was talking to some people I think it was Hasbro Interactive was the company that was developing it. And I remember talking to some people about it. And I said, you know, I actually do have some ideas. And this is so many years later. I said, I actually do have some new ideas for where to take Qbert and what to do with the character. And they were like, oh, we'd love to hear that. And I was like, all right, well, let's see what we can work out, you know, contract wise. And they're like, oh, well, we can't pay you.
Yeah, yeah. We just
we'll take your ideas. We just can't pay you anything.
Yeah, I mean, we'd much rather you just tell us what your ideas are, and we'll gladly make some things happen.
That's not the way it works. So anyway, I have literally never had anything to do with anything Qbert related. I didn't even get invited to the premiere of Wreck-It Ralph or Pixels. Nothing.
Oh wow! Wow!
Yeah.
Wow, that is wild. And now you mentioned that you went on to work with Disney Interactive, things like that, continuing to create gaming and interactive experiences. Where has that led you?
Well, you know, I got out of the arcade industry when I moved to Los Angeles in 1996. And I worked for Disney. For a while, I was an Imagineer. I moved from Disney Interactive to Disney Imagineering.
Oh, wow.
And for a brief time, I worked on Toontown, which was an online multiplayer online world. But I didn't contribute very much, and I didn't really enjoy that. I actually spent a lot of my time twiddling my thumbs. I wasn't put to very good use, I didn't think, and I ended up leaving that job after a few months. But I stayed in the industry. I worked on some console games for some small studios, and had some notoriety there. I have to say, I worked on the fourth Spyro game, Spyro the Dragon, which was a terrible bomb. and that's a whole story unto itself. I'm not going to get into that here. I will write a chapter on that in my memoir if I get around to it.
Which we will not get into here.
Yeah. But someday. And yeah. And then I had a variety of jobs using these skills, and I did keep my skills up to date, you know, all through the 2000s. And the last regular job that I had was for ILM, which was a wonderful, wonderful experience. For years, I wished I could work for ILM, and I eventually did.
And so, I do see your Skywalker Ranch shirt on presently. Exactly what did you do with ILM?
So I was hired because I lived in Los Angeles, and they're based in San Francisco.
Yep.
But I was hired because I lived in Los Angeles. At the time, they were thinking of basically loaning or selling. I'm assuming eventually selling, but let's say at the beginning, loaning their software to do pre-visualization for movies. Previs is where it's sort of a high-tech version of storyboarding.
Yeah.
So when you have big, expensive action sequences, you can mock them up in what, you know, is essentially a video game engine. And then before you make all the, you know, expensive mistakes, you can work out the problems that way. So they were developing Previs software, and they wanted some studios in the LA area to use it. So I became a technical liaison. So I spent some time up in San Francisco, learn the software, do some maybe development on it, but also come back, work with special effects houses down here who would be using it, and you know, communicate back and forth. So and it was great, except the way it turned out was after a project or two, I think ILM got a new CTO, chief technical officer, and chief technology officer, and he decided that he didn't want their software being used out of house. So there became no need for a technical liaison in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And they kept me on, and I actually did development for them from Los Angeles for a while, months. And then they let me know they were going to lay me off. which was a blow because I actually loved that job. And I thought, if anything, they would invite me to come up and just be full-time developer up in San Francisco, but they laid me off.
Yeah.
So from that point on, I've just been a software consultant here in L.A. And still working in the games industry in some small capacity. So I'm not completely out of the industry, but certainly not working on big titles or anything really modern.
Yeah, yeah. More, like you said, more in the consulting realm, things like that.
Yes.
And of course, speaking, like how I met you, going out and speaking at conferences, that kind of stuff about your realm of experience.
Yeah, that's a whole... That's a whole, you know, crazy, wonderful surprise, too. I'd been to a few of these sort of retro gaming shows, you know, in the early 2000s. The Classic Gaming Expo in Las Vegas invited me out a few times, and I went and had a great time. And I was just, you know, so shocked that people would even be interested in any of these stories. But then, you know, within the last 5 years or so, I got wind of so many more, you know, both Comic-Cons having video game tracks.
Oh, yeah.
And also retro gaming shows devoted to retro games and the kind of games I used to work on. And those people started inviting me to their shows, and it's just kind of blown up. It's astonishing. Well,
I think not only that, but like, I mean, geez, just since the Classic Game Convention, I can't tell you how I've had to be my own parent. I see myself now with my 1-year-old child, and it's like, good God, if he gets his hand on video games. I wasted probably about 4 hours the other day playing Qbert and Frogger after I found them online. I was like, oh man, this is no good. Like, I've ordered a USB joystick. I've gone places now. I may not be coming back, hon. I'm sorry. But there has been such a resurgence, and especially in the music from those kind of video games, the people doing bit crushing things like that, taking the soundtracks and warping them, doing all kinds of stuff, but also just open source game engines where people are creating their own 8-bit video games and that kind of stuff, and starting to program their own games for mobile devices and for app release. I think that people like you who came from what would today be the equivalent of like MySQL world, you know, that kind of stuff, where you did probably a lot of database maintenance and number crunching and things like that just as a software engineer, and then started, like I said, creating worlds, started doing something totally different. And you say a creator, good God, man, you were a Disney Imagineer. Yes, you created worlds.
I really did not. I really did not while I was there. I was there for 4 months. So, yeah, didn't have much of an impact there.
I know. I'm just playing. But, you know, like you really do stand out as something where somebody who is a regular everyday programmer can move into something else, can reach out into another world and start doing something different with the knowledge that they already have.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think that the most important thing for anybody, and it does, you don't have to be a programmer, but you should be doing things that you love. You should be, you know, it's a big world, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of jobs, and you shouldn't feel limited by, you know, whatever situation you're in. You know, there was a guy I used to work with at Bell Labs. He was in his 30s. I mean, I was in my 20s, the early 20s at the time, and he was in his 30s, and he was married, and he had kids, and he was an artist. He was an industrial artist. He used to draw, you know, what a new machine would look like. You know what I mean? The cabinets. It was a very talented artist, but they did some restructuring at Bell Labs, and he ended up in like this same group as I was, and he had to learn programming, and he wasn't a programmer. And, you know, I was like, well, why are you here then? And he basically said, you know, I got a family to support. I got to do whatever they ask me to do because I can't quit and just try something new. I mean, or yeah. try and quit and avoid trying something new. And I always felt like I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be that person who felt trapped. So, you know, I have to say one of the things I've always been able to do is make a change in my life if I feel it's not going the way I want it to go. And I think people need to get past their fear of the unknown and have a little faith. You know, it's like usually it's very rare that there are decisions that you make that you can't unmake. I mean, yes. There are certain things that's where you can't undo. But a lot of times, you know, especially with switching careers, I feel like you can switch. And if that doesn't work out, you can switch again. So,
yeah. And we're actually in a really interesting point right now. I saw just the other day with my other podcast that I do. We cover a lot of news topics and things. And I noticed that there was this huge trend going on and people covering the fact that there is an insane amount of job hopping going on in the market right now, where people are actually able to go out, find another job with another company in their industry and make more money. You know, but it does take that like willingness to get out of your comfort zone. You know, you gotta be willing to kind of take that step and make that change for yourself. I remember the day, like you were saying a while ago, negotiating things. I remember the day that I negotiated my first rate, and as I walked away from it, it was like, God, I should have asked for more. They took that number so sweetly and so fast. I should have asked for more and had to negotiate. You know, now I'm stuck at this rate forever until we've worked for a few years and we can renegotiate things. And I can go, listen, guys, my rate's gone up.
Well, so, I mean, if you feel that that's an important thing for you, then that's what you should ask for.
Well, yeah. And it's gotten to the point now in my career where I make no bones about asking what I ask for. I ask for it because I've been doing what I do for 20 years and I'm pretty knowledgeable at what I do and putting out the fires I put out, things like that. And that's something that we talk about a lot on this show, is having the courage to say, I want to do this more than part time. I want to follow through with this. And even you, having the vision when you did of saying, oh, you know, this is pretty cool, I might want to get into it. Then seeing an ad and going, maybe I should get into it. And just kind of taking that leap. Like, it was totally unfamiliar territory for you. I'm sure that maybe, much like many of my friends who did computer programming and stuff in high school, you possibly had like programmed some blackjack on your calculator, stuff like that, to keep you occupied in calculus class. But as far as programming a video game, it's not really something that you'd considered, you know?
Yeah, no, I had very little experience with computer graphics. I mean, computer graphics were pretty new. You know, I don't think there was any such thing as computer graphics when I started college. I mean, it kind of evolved while I was in college to the point where when I was a senior, we started getting computer terminals that were actually capable, you know, like CRT terminals. Like you just never saw them before that.
Yeah, before that, it was just a faceless machine that did some calculations for you.
Well, it was punch cards. You'd literally type your program, you'd punch them on these decks of cards, and you'd carry them to the computer center and wait a day to get your printout. You know?
Yeah, it was all Fortran and things like that. You didn't really have need for a GUI. You didn't have need for pixels, so to speak, anything like that. that. So for you to actually see that growth is much like myself, being born in 75, being a child of the 80s. I was about 7 years old when Qbert was released. So for me, like I said, it's a voice of my childhood. Like Qbert to me is like remembering my grandmother's voice. Like it was there. It was just always there when I was a kid, you know. Yeah. And for that to have evolved into now virtual reality is a thing. And that was just like theorized when I was in high school in the 90s. You know, movies like Lawnmower Man were coming out. But if you look at that, even looking at that now, like the zero G chair, the headset that he's using, the gloves, like every bit of that is what we're using for VR now. There were consultants, there were people like you who were like, oh no, this is the technology that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the concept, like with every piece of technology, the concepts exist in people's imaginations long before the actual technology is created. And that's true of, you know, video games. I mean, people look at Star Wars with the chess set, you know, on the Millennium Falcon, you know, the holographic chess pieces, you know. We'll get there someday because it exists in our imaginations. And the same thing is true of virtual reality. I mean, the actual original virtual reality work was done, I think, in the early 1980s. People were actually developing virtual reality stuff. So, technology is amazing. I mean, when we were doing our little, you know, 16 color crude graphics, I think everybody working in the industry envisioned a time where video games would look, you know, the way they look now. You know, I think we really envisioned truly interactive movies. I know that I did, that I was always thinking that that's where we're going towards, basically an interactive movie, that it just has that realistic quality graphics and you're just in it, but you're controlling it. Well, and that's kind of where we're at right now.
Yeah, and even at the same time, like back in the late to mid 80s when games like Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, I'm trying to remember the one, not Space War, but the other one that you were talking about that was a Laserdisc game.
Mach 3?
Yes. When those games started coming out, it was Dragon's Lair especially was like you were playing a movie. It was like you were playing a cartoon. You know, you responded left or right or sword to flashes on the screen, but the game played out in front of you. All you did was make some decisions on behalf of the character here and there. It kind of took this choose your own adventure concept, but at the same time, very enveloping. Even to this day, I have Dragon's Lair on my phone. It's something that I play on planes, things like that, because it's just, it's super enveloping, and it's amazing that that technology existed even back then. They were looking at laser discs. They were looking at holographic technology. They were looking at all of this kind of stuff to engage players in a different way.
Yeah. And I got to make a Laserdisc game. It was actually made as a kit that went into Mach 3 cabinets called Us Versus Them.
Oh.
And I'm more proud of that game than maybe any other game I've worked on. I mean, it was really kind of revolutionary. We had scenes with actors. So there was a story that progressed from level to level. It had a lot of variety in the gameplay. And I think that's a really cool game. In fact, I love seeing it when I find a restored cabinet these days. I really love playing it. And it's also playable on PCs. I don't know that it's in MAME, but there's a thing called the Daphne Project that allows you to play a lot of these old Laserdisc games on your PC.
Daphne, probably named after Princess Daphne from Dragon's Lair.
Probably.
But anyway, that's awesome that you say that. I mean, tell us a little bit about the creation of that game, because that really is a precursor to virtual reality. The concept of trying to fully immerse people inside of a visual experience, you know, trying to draw the player in a different way.
We have the LaserDisc player, and so we knew we could do movie quality graphics. The way our hardware was created is basically it was the same as our regular video game hardware, the same as Qbert's hardware, but we replaced the background plane with the movie footage. And so a guy named Dennis Nordman, who's well renowned as a pinball designer, he's still making pinball machines to this day. He was working at Gottlieb at the time, and he had this concept for a sort of a science fiction B movie video game using filmed footage. And I was very excited about that because at the time, you know, I was studying acting, and I was thinking of being an actor at the time. And I knew I was in an acting class, and I had friends that were actors, and some of them ended up being in this thing. And so, you know, we created a story, and we had to sort of think it through. How would this work? Practically speaking, like it can't be like a real movie, because if you're controlling a plane and you're shooting at something, you can't just cut away to something to another shot or another angle. It would be totally disorienting. So we had to sort of figure out the rules, and we came up with this idea of like maybe a 10 to 15 second cutscene at the beginning of each level. So you're in the control room and you're hearing, and the story's evolving with the commander and the people in the control room talking to the pilots. And then you cut to a pilot, and then you're that pilot. And then you cut to the flying footage, and it's just basically computer generated alien ships and your jet fighter on a filmed background. But we also tried to make it more cinematic by using different angles. So some levels it's like a first person view, some levels it's like a horizontal scrolling view, some levels it's like you're above and behind the plane looking slightly down, some levels your plane is in the distance and you're shooting towards the front of the screen. I mean, so we played a lot with that. And then there were some bonus levels. There was Return of the Jedi had just come out. So we had a forest level where you're actually flying your plane through a forest, maneuvering around the trees, just like in Return of the Jedi. Total ripoff of that. But, it lent some variety. And then as the story progressed, one of the pilots flies into the mothership that's controlling all of these satellite UFOs. So we were in the mothership. So it really had some depth to it, and I was very proud of it. I really thought we achieved something pretty amazing, especially for its day. It came out in, I think, 1983.
I was going to say, if it came out at the same time as Return of the Jedi, that was quite a while back. And that was still well within the realm of 8-bit technology. You were still looking, there were a few 16-bit things out there, but it wasn't really like the mainstay of what was going on in home platforms or what was happening at the arcade on the regular.
The problem with the LaserDisc games and Us Versus Them, the problem with it, because it had fantastic test results when we put it in arcades, it was number one consistently, it earned a lot of money, but the problem was that was right at the time where everybody realized that LaserDisc games were basically not ready for the arcades. People would smack the side of it. The LaserDisc would skip. They'd lose their game. They'd ask for their money back. This was happening a lot. And what happened with Gottlieb was that their distributors canceled all of their orders for Us Versus Them. And then there was a lawsuit, and it was just kind of a disaster. So, the LaserDisc, debacle of 1984 kind of destroyed Us Versus Them, I think, from getting the shot it really needed to be remembered as a great game. It just didn't get out there as much as it could have.
Yeah, like I said, I remember seeing Space Ace, playing Space Ace, and all the games like that were LaserDisc platform. And the problem, like you said, things would skip. They didn't really account for the fact that like throngs of kids gather around one person while they play a game and shake the machine, things like that, cheering them on, and all that kind of stuff. They just didn't have the buffering technology, things like that, that we have now, that prevent the skipping from happening. The technology to be able to just embed that into a solid state drive. Now, what kind of stuff are you presently consulting on? I mean, can you share any of that with the audience? It's interesting that you've gone to the realm of consulting from design. That is always the realm that I'm telling people who have moved on to that chapter in their career, like, you should just get into private consulting with people.
It's the same work. It's the same work. I still have the same skills. I mean, again, we talked earlier about keeping your skills current, and I've tried to do that. But, that's one of the downsides of being in the computer world is that, you know, you're always having to learn something new. Whatever you used to know, it becomes quaint and maybe useful, you know, in some retro way. But, new technology is changing and you got to keep on top of it. But luckily, I actually was asked by Sony. They've released a bunch of their old PS2 games on their PS4 platform. And the PS4 platform has trophies, which are like achievements where, when you accomplish certain things, you earn trophies. And so I've actually been hacking into these old games, which is pretty challenging and actually fun because a lot of times we don't have any source code. We don't have any symbols. We literally just have assembler language, and we have to sort of dig in and figure out what's going on and how these games are doing what they're doing, and then finding the right hooks and conditions in order to award trophies. So I've been doing some of that, and that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Challenging.
And into the realm of deconstruction and stuff like that, really reverse engineering things from an existing platform. And that's...
Yeah, exactly.
That's wild. It's a whole different world. I myself do quite a bit of that in pedal modification, that kind of stuff, opening up guitar pedals and circuits and having to deconstruct them from where they are in order to change things as they exist. And it's an interesting way to start to look at things. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with my audience, with myself, about these things. I think, like I said, it's really interesting for someone with your pedigree in the world of gaming to be going around and sharing your knowledge, sharing your experience and your personal journey with young coders, with young people that are coming up in this industry. What would be a few pieces of advice that you would give someone that's considering going into video game design as a possible career path?
I mean, nowadays, I would say, first of all, figure out where you want to be, because the landscape is so big. There are so many different ways a person can contribute to a video game. You know, there are designers, there are programmers, there are artists. Even in those three broad categories, there are specialties, right? So I'd say figure out what it is that excites you. And I would also say there are so many tools available to anybody to make their own video games, simple video games, but you've got the Unreal Engine, you've got Unity. I mean, a single person can whip together some pretty interesting things. And I'd say teach yourself what it is to make a video game. One thing I would caution people that playing a video game is not the same as making one. So if you love playing video games, that doesn't necessarily mean you would love making them. I think those are different skills.
Yes, they're mutually exclusive.
There's a whole world of championship video game playing. So you could actually make a career being a video game player if that's what you want to do. It's such a different world than it used to be. But I would say figure out where you want to fit in. And then learn about that and learn what you need to know to be able to fit in there. And also create as much as you can on your own, so you have a portfolio of something to show somebody that will give them an idea that you're, first of all, let them know you're serious, and then it'll give them an idea of your abilities and skills. And, you know, hopefully you'll find somebody willing to give you a break and let you, you know, enthusiasm goes a long way. I think employers really appreciate people who are enthusiastic about their jobs. So,
yeah, passion is really, despite any industry, what it takes to succeed. Mm-hmm. You really do have to have an appreciation and a love for what it is that you're doing. And you quite obviously do, Warren. That's one reason why, even just sitting backstage as you were and watching your program in reverse, watching a mirror image of your PowerPoint presentation of the creation of Qbert and everything, I was just wowed and fascinated and riveted as you talked, because as you can tell, I'm passionate about the game Qbert. I loved it as a kid, and it meant a lot to me. And to know that someone like you, even our talk afterward, very organically followed the same path to his career that I did, you know, where it was like you went and did something totally different with the knowledge that you had than what your expected path of that knowledge was. And kudos to you for following that, taking up that gauntlet and moving down that path, because people like you are who inspire people like my audience, people like myself, to keep doing what we're doing, and to keep forging forward, to keep finding new ground and keep exploring new things within ourselves and within our industries.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. It's very kind. I truly am amazed at the interest in my old stories, and that's really the only reason I do them. I mean, I'm not exactly a person who, you know, needs attention, so I really enjoy the contact I have with people who appreciate my stories. If people want, as long as people want to hear them, I'll keep telling them.
Well, absolutely.
Hopefully I won't turn into that grumpy old guy who just keeps telling their stories when everybody stops wanting to hear them.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm hoping for, too. and on that note, I know that you are working on a memoir. We aren't really talking about that a whole lot. But whenever it does come out, please know that you are invited to come on, share some more of your stories, more of the intricacies as you have reflected back on your career, its impact, how it's impacted you, how you've impacted the world, things like that. I can't wait to hear that. I myself have worked on quite a few projects in a similar way, and it really is a formative process to come to. So good for you for taking that on.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line as we wrap this episode. As you're online, checking out great versions of Qbert that you can go out and find, everybody, make sure to check out some of the great work of Warren Davis that's out there. Check into some of the games that we were talking about, Us Versus Them, all that kind of stuff. Go out there, get inspired, challenge yourself in new ways every day in your industry. While you're online doing that, make sure to check out TalkingSoundShow.com, where you can find all of the technical articles that we post through our RSS feeds. You can find all of our episodes. You can also find us on the HC Universal Network. That's HCUniversalNetwork.com. Also, your local podcast app for HC Universal Network. It's absolutely free. Go check it out. Talking Sound Show, Dudes and Beer. There's probably about 8 or 9 different podcasts on the network right now. So all kinds of great entertainment. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves. Take care of your hearing. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.